Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is author Gerard Byrne, who you might also know as the curator of the online magazine The Irish Literary Times. His latest novel, The Thickness of Ice, is out now with Baraka Books. Gerard, I'm going to, as you know, if you've ever listened to the podcast, you know I always go back to where people started off. So am I right that you're a Tipperary, but you were born in Tipperary?
I was born in Tipperary, but I have no connection in my mind to Tipperary. I was a baby and we moved when before I was two. So, and even in our family stories, no offense to Tipperary, but it wasn't coming up in stories. My dad was moving around a lot of the time and so on. So I grew up in Cavan and I really see myself therefore as having kind of, you know, even though born in Tipperary, that I kind of grew up from 2 years upwards in Cavan till I was college age. Yeah.
Okay, so Cavan until you were college age. And what kind of, like, were you in a big family? What was your, like, what was your childhood sort of environment like? And, you know, were books around?
Yeah, look, I always think I was blessed, really. My parents are, my mom has passed away recently, a couple of years back. Oh. My dad's still in his 90s and alive. And they're just the finest parents you could ask for. And I had two sisters. And we just had a very safe, comfortable environment growing up. My eldest sister was a big reader, and I think we all just kind of, you know, there were books in the house. My dad had books in the house. He'd been a member of a book club sometime and accumulated certain books. But so I played a lot of golf. My dad was a great golfer. I guess we all played golf at a certain point, but predominantly my mom, my dad and myself played golf through those years. Once I got to college, I didn't think you could play golf when you went to college in Dublin. How would you? You know? So I let it go. But and I was writing from, and I say this, I'm not saying this to say this is better or it's my experience is better than someone else's. I was writing from the moment I could put a pen in my hand. You know, that's just where I was. That's just was a part of me. And it doesn't make me, as I said, a better writer or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it's just a reality. So all along through my childhood, I know I wasn't telling a lot of people, but I was, you know, I was writing away too. That was part of.
So that impulse was there right from the beginning.
That's exactly what it was. It was an impulse. And I would, I have things I found at home when I was 5, 6, 7 years of age, writing scripts, and cowboy scripts. And, you know, I have a book. I got, my dad had some sort of a hardback kind of book he was done and finished with from the office or something. And I used it as, I thought it was like a real book. And when I see the story now, it was the you know, the shoemaker with the magic shoes and the elves and that. It was a version of that. That's all it was. I was plagiarizing. But I thought it was, you know, and so I was making my own book at, again, about 6 years of age or something, making this. But I was drawn to it and it was very much part of my childhood. But back then, Ruth, no, there was no encouragement in the arts in general in the community. And certainly at secondary level, when I was very seriously writing, again, I wouldn't tell anyone because there was just nothing. Now there's an arts officer in Cavan and there's a great cultural community and artistic community and so on. But it was kind of, times were tougher and maybe the value wasn't put on it.
So it was quite a sort of a secretive thing, but not secretive, but... Yeah, covert.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose I probably would have been embarrassed to tell people even, you know, but it was just something that was constantly ongoing in some fashion. I'm not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you remember what, like, were you, you say like your first, you remember like plagiarizing your first tiny little story when you were a little boy? Like, do you remember what other books were maybe kind of lodged in your imagination then in that sense too, as you were growing up?
Well, you know, we grew up on the Enid Blyton story books, and that was it. We, you know, they were the big books in our childhood, and loved them. You know, just adored those books. And I do remember that at primary school, so that from second class up, let's say, we were brought to the library once a week to go and get books and then bring it back. And well, I say once a week, maybe it wasn't, maybe it's once every few weeks, but we were brought on a consistent basis. And I remember there being exposed to, you know, not that we didn't go to the library as children ourselves, but this was more concerned. I would try out more books beyond my means. And, you know, maybe I was trying to impress the teacher. I don't know. But I think it was more those kind of Dina Blyton that was at that stage. And going from, there were lots of other books around those types of ones. I won't remember the names, but the Billy Bunter ones and all those kind of youthful, fun kind of. I mean, if we look back at them now, yes, we could be critical about the language in them and so on and so forth. But they brought a lot of pleasure at the time. I think I was unawares of that. So, and then, of course, a shift happens as you get a bit older. And there's, and again, my eldest sister Anne was reading, in my memory, she was reading a lot more. And she'd had books that they were doing at school as well, you know, coming into the house. And at some point, I discovered Steinbeck and I just fell in love with Steinbeck. I just absolutely loved his writing. And I suppose that was the shift from the kind of more...
I can't think of the word. Yeah. I don't know what the word is either, but I don't know exactly.
And what I'm stalling is, nowadays we have children's books and young adult books and adult books. I'm not sure. To me, this seemed like all children's books I was reading. Was there a young adult, really? Maybe the kind of Mallory Towers, although
yeah, there seemed to be just that. There was like basically you had your series like that, the Enid Blyton books or whatever, and then you just and then that was there was no yeah
there was no in between. It's how it felt.
Yeah,
but that, so be it. I discovered Cannery Row, and that was, of course, there was, you know, the Pearl and all these ones to come in from the Leaving Cert and whatever,
yes,
whichever, but Cannery Row was pivotal really because it was fun. It was very, very serious. And I also became aware of certain writing techniques that Steinbeck was doing. I was running class only last night on the short story, and I brought one of them into the class, in fact, because I remember Steinbeck had a character. Sorry if I'm going off track here now. Steinbeck had a character in the house saying that he wanted to go across to Lee Chong's grocery store across the road and get a beer. And then the very next sentence, he's in this at the counter buying the beer. And I said, you can't do that. You can't, you know, interrupt time like that and pretend nothing. You know, you need at least a gap. But he didn't. And it just stayed with me. You actually can do these things. And if Steinbeck can do it, I can do it too. And there was just so much in that book that
that's actually,
So
I was going to say that's actually a really pivotal lesson or very important lesson to learn as a writer, isn't it?
Yeah. You had another lovely one time. These are just ones that have stayed. And this one is, it's the one where they're traveling on the bus and there's a whole bunch of them and they get off at different stops. But at one stage, one person goes into the kind of like a diner and there's a waitress behind the counter and she rubs at her earlobe. And the point of view we're in, which is the man in the shop, probably third person, but he imagines her feeling the little lumps that you can feel underneath your skin when you rub your earlobe. And again, I just thought that was incredible.
Magic.
He wasn't imagining what she's thinking, just what she actually feeling in there at this moment in time. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's so. It's interesting. I've come extremely late to Steinbeck because my son is doing it for junior cert. He was reading Of Mice and Men, so it's my first. Isn't that incredible? I got to this age and I haven't read any Steinbeck. And yeah, I mean, I didn't know what to expect with that novel. I've heard some various opinions on it, but I'm just absolutely blown away. And this is 2025, you know. And when was that novel written? And it I don't know. To me, it was so subtle and ambiguous, and yet at the same time so stark and so passionately kind of affecting at the same time. It was, I don't know how.
Yeah, no, I think he was just a fabulous storyteller. I think that's what I admired. There was nothing tricky. I mean, it's deep stuff. It's deep stuff. And you know, Cannery Row is very philosophical and very religious. And I love that he could bring these things in, but just tell a great story. With his characterization for me was just wonderful. I just fell in love with these people, and I think that's what I liked about him. And somewhere along that line, just to connect it, the other writer that became huge, so different, but Somerset Maugham. And at a young age, for some reason, his stories, we definitely did one story in school, in one of our anthologies that, you know, are in school that I enjoyed. But I ended up just reading, I suppose, in my probably 16, 17, 18, that type of thing, just reading. And then, of course, writing like Somerset Maugham. I adored his work. I haven't gone back to it in years, and whether it holds up or not, I don't know. But he was quite the hero at the time in terms of just what appealed to me as a human being, in what I wanted to read and what I wanted to write like.
Mm. Yeah. And were you reading like Graham Greene around that time?
I probably came later to Graham Greene, who is one of my all-time favorite writers now. I went back the year before last, I went back and read about a dozen Graham Greene again. Absolutely loved his work. But at that stage, no. I just hadn't happened on him. I'd say my reading range was pretty narrow. I wasn't exposed to a lot. I'm not going to blame myself for that. I just wasn't, for whatever reason, exposed to a lot.
It's just what you say there about character and the kind of writing. I just thought that kind of fitted into that sort of little.
It absolutely does. You're spot there. On. And Greene would be a huge influence on me now at this stage.
No, but then, so I mean, it doesn't sound narrow to me at all. But okay, I mean, I know things have changed now. There's probably a wider array of things available to people. But so did you, like, so you're reading and you're kind of not, you're kind of internalizing it and trying things out yourself as a kind of a young
writer. Well, I was writing, like I did with the fairy tale, I was writing versions of Steinbeck and versions of Somerset Maugham without realizing it. And I take that as plagiarism. It's not plagiarism. It's how you learn to write. You find a style you admire and you like it so much, you unconsciously begin writing that way. And so I do have, you know, books at home with short stories I wrote over summers and things like that. But they're all pastiche, if you want to put it that way.
A sort of ventriloquizing a little bit. Yeah.
And at the time, I thought they were great. I thought they were...
Well, absolutely. You're writing in the style of Steinbeck. I mean, it's going to read very well. But we're jumping ahead a little bit because I just wanted to ask you there on voice. You know, was there a moment when you kind of realized, now I'm writing, this is me now, this is my voice, this is, and I'm comfortable and confident in it? Was there a moment when that happened, or was it just a very gradual kind of, you get through all the osmosis and then you're out the other side?
I think it's more the latter, but there was a point where I recognized this is not like other people necessarily. And there was a dramatic shift in my voice. But I don't think, you know, I think over my college years, I did engineering and I don't think I was writing a lot during, that was super busy. And over the summers, I was writing some. And I really, really got back to it again when I got my first job. And I do remember I went to a writer's workshop at that stage. Andrew Miller was in it, starting out his writing life too. And there was just a great bunch of us in there. You know, there was an extended group, about 14, but there were five or six core members. But I remember trying out lots of different things in that group and being given the space to do that. And I was definitely, you know, people would tend to call it experimenting, but I don't like that term. I don't think experimenting sounds kind of trivial or something. It was exploring for sure and different voices. And I was definitely breaking down narrative and trying different structural things and testing the boundaries of it. And, I do know I was at that during that period of time.
And Jared, where are we at this stage? Are you at college or is this after?
At this stage, I would have finished college. I've jumped because I don't remember doing a lot of writing during college. I would have over the summers. I would still have been doing the kind of reading Maugham at that stage. I wasn't letting him go. But I wasn't that taken with a lot of Irish writers. And that was just my kind of, you know, it felt too closed or something. And it wasn't interesting me. And so Salinger was a huge person I was reading at that stage. Not so much, of course, Catcher in the Rye brought me to Salinger. But when I discovered For Esme with Love and Squalor, his short story collection called Nine Stories in the States, I think, And that was massive, you know. Uncle Wiggly in Connecticut, and a great day for banana food. I'm actually getting the shivers as I say those names now, not having said them in years, because I had never read a voice like that before. And again, it gave me permission to try out new things. And I think that's when I jumped now to the writing group in my first workplace in Bristol, where I lived.
Ah, okay.
There was definitely massive Salinger influences coming in there, as well as other things. But I got exposed to a range. In Bristol, the bookshops were different, it seemed to me then. Maybe they weren't, but it seemed to me. And I probably discovered the Beats at that stage rather than earlier, and all that type of writing.
And so this is when, so you'd obviously left Ireland then for college.
I left Ireland. I did college, I did engineering. You know, I probably should have done English. That would have been where my heart was. But again, we're in a time, I finished school I started college in 1980. So I finished school that year, 1980. And there was no value, as far as I could see, in the arts in Europe. I was good at math. I really liked math. And I was actually decent enough at math. And the push was, go into the sciences, go into engineering. You're good at math and you're taking honours math. And that year, there were only five of us taking honours math. It was a whole lot of time. And so why would you not be doing it? And so I got pushed into that in a sense. And I don't regret that at all. But I had more of an aptitude for English if I had, or the arts, the humanities or something, probably. When I graduated in 84, I did mechanical engineering. There's just no jobs, none at all in Ireland. It's just that period. Electronic engineers, many of my friends were getting snapped up by Siemens and Philips and taken to Germany and various places. But the mechanical and civil, we were kind of left twiddling our thumbs at that point. So I headed to England and just went to the job fairs, and I managed to land myself a job there. So
I'm wondering, when did the pull of North America happen? You mentioned when you were talking about Salinger and co there, and I could feel that sort of, you know, you're bristling with excitement reading those voices. And I'm sort of wondering, did that sort of instill something early on? Like, did it instill a real curiosity?
It did. These were just my biases. I was biased against Irish writers, the type of writing I was reading at the time. I had read McGarren. I'd read all of these. And then I thoroughly enjoyed McGarren. But I didn't want to read more of that story. And I think if I'm going to be very just honest with all this, you know, we grew up on the Western movies, which I loved. And so that culture of the West was something that appealed to me. And I would read, if I could get American writers, I would read American writers. And I must have had exposure to some at that stage. I can't remember who, to be quite honest. But that was where my interest was. Definitely, I wanted to read American literature. I did at a certain point. I no longer wanted to read anything, let's say, Irish and so on. But it wasn't easy to do because it wasn't in my awareness. That's what I'm trying to get at. Maybe there's specialized shops you could go to, but I just don't remember it being that way. There wasn't that exchange for me. Maybe if I was taking an English degree, it would have been different. But for me, I wasn't being exposed to a lot of this. But somewhere along the way, that is where my interest, you know, was going. And I'm trying to piece this together for you and myself here. I got my job in 85. Mm-hmm. And in 91, I went to America to do an MFA in creative writing.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So between 85 and 91, that is where I am heading as a writer. I'm heading to, you know, reading American writers, but probably more along the Beats and things like that. Not exposed to the great writers that suddenly I was exposed to when I was there in 91. Suddenly it's all in front of me. And it's like, how could I not know who these people are? How could I be so ignorant? I had the classic American writers that had made it onto lists and schools.
Yes. But what was it like when you got there in 91 after?
Oh my God, it was one of the great experiences of my life. That book, The Thickness of Ice, is dedicated to one of my writing instructors of the time, John Keeble. And John, well, I back up a little bit. There is an Irish connection to that because a wonderful man who sadly died a few years ago, James Macaulay, an Irish poet, he had moved to America as a young man too, and had ended up, I think, co-founding this MFA up in Spokane in Washington State. And so himself and John Keeble and other people were involved in that program. And they had not many, but other Irish had gone there before, including Paula Meehan. She had done an MFA out there. And so they used to bring the Eastern Washington Summer Workshop to Ireland. And it was a 2-week workshop. And students from across America would take it and get credits for their college and so on. And one year they gave 3 places competitively to Irish writers to take part in it. And I managed to get one of those. And that is something that was happening at that stage. I was getting more involved I was expanding beyond just being a writer for myself and actually getting some work published, poems and different things,
okay,
and stories, and starting to kind of enter into that area, I guess. And I did get, I got onto the summer workshop, and that was just a fabulous, fabulous experience for me. Just to, there were a range of writers on it. You know, I get confused who was there at the time. Certainly Tom McIntyre, another Cavan writer, was part of that. But there were other American writers, and Evan Boland might have been there. And there was just a great buzz around it. And at the end, Jim described the piece I had handed in, which was pushing boundaries, no question. And he said, "This is like a cross between Flann O'Brien and Samuel Beckett." And I have to be straight up, to my shame, I had never read either of them, because I had pushed away so much Irish writing and was immersing myself in other things. I actually hadn't read Flann O'Brien and Beckett at that stage. This is just,
wow.
What an admission for me to make, but there we go. But I loved that I hadn't, because then I thought, he sees something of the Irish voice coming through in this. Anyway, he said, "Would you come out? Have you ever thought about the MFA? Would you come out and do it?" And that's
That's, I mean, I'm getting excited retrospectively for you.
Well, it was very exciting time, very exciting time. Now, stuff has happened in between. I should backtrack.
Yes, I think there's like
my job, I was working as an engineer, and then I was designing dishwashers and toasters, and this is what I was doing.
Okay.
And we were bought out by General Electric, and the big project we were doing, which was a dishwasher that was going to fit in under your draining board. It was going to be so good. Small one, hadn't been done before. This was our thing. And that project got stalled, and my boss said to me, "You know, it's time to start looking around for a new job." You know? So that was coming to an end. And at the time I got engaged and got married. That's what happened.
I can see there's another story going on there.
On and off, and I just cut through that. But we made the decision, now is the time to get married. And this is the time. My job had come to an end. And when we got to see, and we went to Africa for a year, and we just upped and out of everything and went in into Sierra Leone. We went to a small village in Sierra Leone for 12 months. My wife at the time was had trained as a doctor. She just finished her training, and she went out as that, and I went out as a hospital administrator into voluntary positions. So the idea of moving and movement and going to another place, you know, has already been kind of set up, I guess. And that's where I discovered Graham Greene, because Graham Greene had written about Sierra Leone,
that's right.
He has a famous setting in there in a hotel. And I went in to visit the hotel at one point, which sounds easy, but it's not easy. We were in the bush, basically, and the idea of getting through this. But I did get up to Freetown. We got to the hotel, which is now, at the time, it was a DOS house at that stage. It was owned by someone, but it was just people could just come and go and sleep in it and drink and whatever else. So, but I did go and sit in the balcony there for an afternoon. And Graham Greene books were everywhere in the community. I was kind of mixing with, as you can imagine. So that again, it was an important part, because we are going back to Green and the importance of Green. And you really I was reading loads from it during that particular year.
But also that year in itself must be.
It's a whole other thing. And the key thing for that is I had stepped out of engineering.
Right.
I have made the move away from, I never went back.
God, gosh, and imagine if that hadn't happened. Imagine if, like, somehow the company had taken off that you were working with and you got promoted and you ended up, you know, and you would have almost been caught. Or that at a different point you wouldn't have been able to move, or you get too comfortable to move. Like, God.
No question. I was given permission, in a sense, when the job pretty much went to make some sort of shift. And
which you probably didn't even see at the time. At the time, you're just caught up in everything, but you can see.
No. I'm just caught up. And it's just like, why don't I go back to Ireland for a while? And why don't we think about our future? And okay, we will get married. And you've been thinking about going to Africa to do some work there. And I wouldn't mind doing that. And then it just happens. And but having made that shift, I'm trying to think when we came back. Oh, I know what happened then is my wife wanted to do some, when we came back from Africa, she wanted to do more training. And we went to Cornwall and we lived in a beautiful part of Cornwall.
My goodness, what a contrast.
And so I again just took the opportunity to go there and write while I was there. And this is where little bits and pieces were starting to happen. I was getting a few things published and so on. And then that
made me. Do you think it's because you were having these kind of, well, I suppose the answer is pretty obvious, isn't it, for a writer, that you were having these really rich experiences, all this kind of otherness, all this kind of like incredible stimuli? Is that, do you think that just kind of rocket fueled your work at that point? Not rocket fuels, but you know what I mean.
It is all part of it. I do know what you're saying there. It is the impulse that you talked about, which is a great word. The impulse to be a writer and the impulse to travel and the impulse to see were connected somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when I was in Africa, for instance, there was a wonderful storyteller called Sally Akaroma who would walk around Sierra Leone and get buses and different things, but he would go into all these small villages and just tell stories. And I was exposed to that, you know, we had traditional Irish storytelling, of course,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't been witness to that really. But I was witness to another type of oral storytelling, very, very much up close. There was little or no written material available at that stage. I did manage to get transcripts of his stories at one point, but that's all I could get my hands on. And I'm not saying there weren't Sierra Leoneans writing, but that the predominant exposure I had in the community I was in was the storyteller and this traveling. All that feeds in. Of course, it does. It absolutely does. And I was writing about my experience, even though I've never done it with it or wouldn't want to. It was raw and whatnot, but
okay,
was still the drive to put something down in relation to this.
So at this stage then in Cornwall, this is pre...
That was after Africa. So
that was Africa, after Africa.
Then there was Cornwall, and before the end, it led directly in. I went from Cornwall to
1991 and the kind of whole horizon just gone.
And that was it. That was well, you know, John Keeble. I walked into the workshop with John for the first time, and he said he was talking about somebody's story or somebody. He called us. He would say the writer. The writer has said this or what. You know, and I just thought, oh my God, he is asking us to take on, you know, not a label, but to take on the onus of being a writer. And that was the shift. I just thought, okay, I can be a writer. That's what I can be.
Wow.
And I threw myself into it. I mean, we did loads of travel and all that because we liked that and we're in this country and went to Alaska and went down into Mexico and Guatemala and did all that during the summers. But I threw myself 100% into that program. It was like a kid in a candy store. That's what it was like. It was just, it's all here. And I could take electives. I can go and do poetry. I can do novel. I can do, you know, I can do whatever I want. And I wrote what became Turtle, which was my second published novel, but I wrote that there. And I also wrote what became my first collection of poems there. Digging my own grave. I put, even though I was a fiction kind of guy, supposedly, I was actually doing as much poetry. I eat it up. and then all the writers, I'd walk into a bookstore. There was a wonderful bookstore in Spokane, Auntie's, and they had a fabulous secondhand section. So I'd go down there and, people like Russell Banks and Ray Carver and all these names that I'd never heard of them. I just had not been exposed to them. Maybe I live in my own little world or something, but Dan, it was just Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's like going from
it is incredible.
Kind of Irish food or traditional Irish food and then suddenly discovering Mediterranean cuisine.
Exactly.
It's just like, wow.
And I think I knew it was there. I was headed for it. I knew it was. And I was in the West, which was important to me because I had those Western myths in my head.
Yes.
And there was a lot of Western writing and Western poets and novelists and short story writers, as well as the broad American span. And the variation of stuff was just remarkable, remarkable to me. And last night I had one of my Irish Writer Center sessions that I teach on the American short story, because I still love the diversity and range of the, we think of it, the Irish kind of owned the short story form sometimes, but I just adored then and still now the range of voice in the American literary world. And it just changed me. It changed me enormously.
And I'm sorry, the name of your, of this first teacher is John Keeble. And do you think, that, because it sounds like, I mean, obviously that sounded like just sort of epiphany after epiphany there, but do you think that that gave you some inkling that you might like to be that kind of teacher? Doesn't even seem like the right word, does it? But
well,
it
was, and twofold, because for me to go out there, I would have to pay international fees, which back in 1991 were $13,000. That was massive. I couldn't afford it. And Jim said, don't worry. He said, we'll get you a TA, a teaching assistant position, and you will get your fees paid.
Brilliant.
Now, I know that Jim fought, and he could fight, and he fought for that position for me because other people didn't think I was ready for that position for various reasons. And there was loads of people wanting them. American people as well. But Jim got me that position. That paid for my fees and a stipend for teaching the course, which covered pretty much the cost of my apartment. That's the only reason I could go out there. And I can still remember, Ruth, oh my God, dreading having to teach. It was my worst nightmare. It's the last thing I wanted to do. And I remember sitting on a bench before going into my first class. I can still see this 35 years ago. And sitting on a bench thinking, I really, really cannot do this.
Cannot.
And having to go in there, a nervous wreck, and teach. And I'll name another name there, because we had a man, Dr. Dana Elder, who ran, he was chair, I guess, of the rhetoric and composition department, who ran these teaching positions, because they were all teaching essay writing to the undergraduates. Compulsory courses. And we had to do a training there. And I had to train for a year taking courses and going once a week to learn about teaching and to discuss what's going on. And then Dan Elder and some of these would come in and sit in our classes and see how they're going and give advice. I landed on my feet with that. I know that now, all these years later, because I actually got a level of training. It's not a full-on training, but most university lecturers don't get any training. They get a PhD or whatever they get and they go in. And that was, again, a great thing. I was there for 2 years. And after the first year, I realized I can do this. It's okay. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
And I managed to get some courses that were hard to get, though competitive, and teaching the short story course, short story writing. As against essay writing. And I managed to get a few extras. So I was teaching a number of modules at the time. And you're right, go back to John. I still quote John in every class 35 years later. He doesn't notice, but I quote him in every class I teach, because I still remember the learnings. And he probably got them from somewhere else, but we passed them on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was that whole thing that I'm writing, I'm teaching, I'm being taught, and I just loved it. And that's why it was such an amazing experience for me personally. Not everyone had that experience on the program.
But completely formative for your writing. And so you say you wrote the second novel that was published, what novels did you write while you were there?
I wrote a novel called Turtle when I was there. And it was kind of the irony was Groundhog Day came out while I was there, but this is written before, but this is a generational Groundhog Day. Generations keep repeating. This is my story growing up in cabin. People just go through generations and they live and they die. And I wanted to get out and I wanted to escape that. And so I did a classic stranger comes to town story where someone comes in to intervene in the generational cycle.
Yes.
And I set it in the West as I saw it, the West being settled and turtle is the turtle myth and all this. And so I set it there, but I wasn't going into First Nations history or anything at all like that. It was just this kind of strange mix of Flann O'Brien and Beckett story that grew into a novel. And I saw it as a Western kind of thing. But the funny thing is people in America thought it was set in Ireland. And so I kind of liked that whole thing. Yeah. So that was written there. And John said to me at the end, he said, most times when you write something for a master's like that, you're not getting it to a publishable stage. We're not even asking for a full, we're only asking for 20,000 words or 30,000 words. And I produced the full thing. But he said, it is publishing. But he said, know that sometime this is publishable. It took 19 years, but it was too odd a book, I think. It was too strange a book. Once I had one book under my belt and a little bit of credibility, I think it was this, I could then venture this one out into the world again.
So you kind of knew then, I suppose, that this is going to be your life. Your life is going to be learning, reading, writing, creating.
Yeah, I didn't
and
know
teaching.
What that's what I would have wanted, but I didn't know how that would pan out. And we went back, and my wife had trained as a family physician at that stage. So we moved around for several years. We were just taking locums, moving around the country. And, right. and one of the, this is the other great thing, is that all during this time, she is saying to me, you just write. Don't go back to engineering if you don't want to, just write. So that was another amazing thing that
yeah.
And at a certain point, I started running my own writing courses tentatively. And Eastern Washington used to bring that summer workshop I told you about over. And I got in there on a tutoring capacity. And
yes.
then I ended up getting a couple of teaching sessions, full teaching sessions. So it was heading that way at that point. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So when do you get to Canada?
Canada was much later. So when we came back from the States, we had family and we had three children. We were living up in, at this stage, up in Moville in Donegal, and Limoges Peninsula. And that's where the book that did come out, the novel that came out first, Eskimo Nanette, that's where that was set. I mentioned I had traveled to Alaska when I was in, we had done a big trip up to Alaska for many months backpacking around. That featured in the book too, is like a connection between it and Donegal. And And we had two children were born there. I have a debt of gratitude to Brian Friel. I never spoke about until there was a thing on Sunday Suddenly about Brian Friel, and Anne said it would be okay to mention it, but it was a private gesture of his. He had given myself and my wife, and when our children, when she was pregnant as well, a cottage on his property overlooking Loch Foyle. Because we couldn't find a place at the time. We weren't in a suitable place. And he heard there was a writer there, and he rang me up one day out of the blue and just said, there's a place here if you want to come and have a look. And it's not good condition, but I know you're looking for somewhere and you can have it if you want. As a kind of gift to the arts or something. And so all those little connections are so important because we did not, Brian, quite rightly so, as a private individual and had his own home, and I wanted to respect that. But he would come down once, every so often and drop off the TLS that he had, and we'd chat a little bit about stuff, not about writing, never about writing, other things. But it was a great place to write, and I was writing very, very seriously my novel at that stage and living there. So, there's just all these important steps. I have enormous debt of gratitude to Brian and Anne. And our first child was born when we were in the cottage. We went out in the middle of the night to the hospital, and I guess Anne woke up and heard the car, and there were flowers the next morning waiting for us when the baby was born. It's just lovely stuff.
Oh.
I was getting very serious about it. And then this opportunity to go to the States, and we decided we would and do this and go to, where am I in my thinking?
Canada.
Oh, we went to Dublin for a while, and we lived in Dublin for several years. And I was doing a lot of teaching in the Irish Writers' Centre at that stage. And my first book of poems was starting to come out. That's what it was, with Daedalus Press.
Okay.
That had been written, the bulk of it, in my MFA, but I was continuing to write on that. And the first book came out in 1997. And in 1998, we went to Canada. Yeah.
Okay. So you sort of left the Irish writing scene at that point then?
I did. And, you know, in some way it was a mistake. In some way it was the best thing ever happened. Not, I don't mean leaving the Irish writing scene, sorry, folks. I just mean going to Canada. But I always feel if I had stayed at that stage with a book coming out, you know, and if I was to get involved and do some readings and bring out a second book or whatever in Ireland, I would have had a different publishing experience coming through in Ireland. But we only went, you know, for a year and a half's adventure. The children were young. We had a 5-month-old baby, Sarika, my daughter, and we had 2 children, and the youngest wasn't at school. And we had 18 months before he started school, and we thought we'd go on an adventure. Where would we go? And there were many options, and one of them was Northern Canada. And I looked at the map to see where it was, and that's when I saw Churchill. And I had this whole Churchill thing. This is something we haven't talked about, but I had loved polar bears all my life for some reason. And I knew of Churchill because it was the most accessible place in the world, even though it's not terribly accessible. It is one of the most accessible places to physically see polar bears. I knew of that. And when I saw the map where this position we could go, my wife could work in and I could accompany her to, because she was going as a physician. And I saw it was far north, but I saw Churchill on the map. And I thought, oh my God, it's a stone's throw. And like stone's throw is about a 17-hour drive away or something. But it was, it just clinched. It's like, yeah, we're going.
Oh, and of course, because I've just finished The Thickness of Ice, Churchill is, you know, I don't even want to use the phrase where the book is set, because it doesn't feel like this book is set. In a sense, it feels like it's sort of in a kind of subconscious landscape, sort of tethered to reality, but it's not real, but it's incredibly believable and beautiful. It's just an extraordinary novel. I haven't read anything like it. I actually just haven't read anything like it. So I'm very glad that you moved to Canada when you did, because I mean, maybe the themes would have found its way into another book anyway. Because if you say you were already sort of entranced by bears, and you know, you had your trip to Alaska, is obviously something that draws you to kind of isolated landscapes and ruggedness and barrenness and all of that kind of thing, like, you know, Inishowen, and even, I mean, I know Cornwall's probably quite a sedate version of it, but still the kind of you're drawn to that. So maybe somehow the same thing would have come out in another way, but this is so like, oh my goodness. Well, you tell me then about moving there and how maybe.
Yeah, well, we moved there, so we're unsure because we have a baby, 5 months old, and we're moving up to very far north in Canada to a First Nations community. And we really, our experience we were thinking back to our experience in Africa, which was, we had a generator in the hospital. So we had electricity in the hospital, but the generator got turned off. So we had no electricity at nighttime. We're living in candlelight and this and lamps and things like that. And for a year, quite remote, quite primitive. And I don't mean that, pejorative.
No, I understand.
Primitive conditions. And we weren't sure what it was like there. And it was very hard to get information. This is pre-internet. It's very hard to find out. So we didn't know what we were bringing a young baby into. And a boy who was 2.5 and another boy who hadn't quite turned 4. So there was a risk in it in some levels, but it appealed to both of us. And we took the family and we went there for this 18-month contract. My wife was a physician and there was a hospital up there. And we went working there. And then I was going to mind the kids and maybe get some writing done. And that is what we did for a year and a half, and then extended for another year and a half. We loved it so much. And our children started schooling up there in at some point. And one of them, and there was another going to kind of a preschool type of setting they had. So after 3 years there, we had to make a decision. Do we stay on? And we had met some people who had moved up there and lived their whole lives there. And there were questions around that. Oh, and the other big thing, the reason we stayed an extra year and a half predominantly was the boom happened in Ireland. And we could not afford to come home. We knew it. We cannot afford to come home. And we didn't have a house up there. We were renting a property and all that type of thing. But so we stayed on. But we were loving it. We were just absolutely loving it. And I'm telling you, it was like, I was trying to figure out this morning in my mind just, about the winters and stuff out there and that. But, you know, winter spanned, I suppose, 6 months, but there was a tentative lead into it and then a tentative lead out. So 5 months maybe. But you're in this frozen landscape, just completely frozen over. And if you know, you do have to cover every part of you going out most times. And it's not that the temperatures would be, I don't know, I can't remember, but maybe mid minus 20s. But they would get to minus 30s and minus 40s at times. And then with wind chill added into that. So it could be minus 22, but with wind chill, it's minus 35. Mm. So you are, you know, you're really in the throes of winter. And you've got to get out in it. You can't hide away from it. And that was the thing. So I had to get out and bring the kids out. But I just loved it. Again, there's like what happened to me in my MFA days. I just threw myself into it. I was keeping a daily diary. I was finding out as much as I could about the environment. People there knew climate change was real and happening. Mm-hmm. And everywhere in the world is in denial of it. And I was being exposed to that. I got this fabulous opportunity to spend 18 months in an oral history project going around interviewing elders in the community about their lives with a local woman as my she was also doing the project with me. It was a co-shared project. There were certain people who wouldn't talk to me, they would only talk to her and so on, but that was just an insight into a changing world as well, that was, you know, amazing to me. I don't even know how this happened. I still really don't. I got invited to the Winnipeg Writers Festival. Somebody got wind that I was up there and thought we could get an Irish writer and there wouldn't be much travel involved.
Yeah.
that's my story. And so I got immersed into the Canadian writing world at that stage also in some strange way. And now when I say I got down to this, getting to this festival is no joke. You know, I am... If you were to drive it, probably about a 10-hour drive through the boreal forest down to it, in these hazardous conditions a lot of the time. I didn't do many trips like that out of the community. We stayed in the community. The community was cut off by water. So once the winter hit, you could get out over a nice road, over one of the rivers and things like that. During the summer, you'd have a ferry, like a two-car ferry that would bring people over and back. But for periods of freeze-up and break-up, you can't get in or out.
Yes. Because
it's not safe. So there was a real, real sense of isolation in that community. And again, I just adored it. I loved it.
I think that's what I loved. So one of the many things I loved so much about the thickness of ice, you know, how it starts, is that kind of the... Everything that your language, the metaphors, even the characters' feelings, everything is kind of wedded to the landscape, to the changing patterns of the ice. But you know, tell us a little bit about the book. It starts we start off with Wade, who's and I loved as well. So many names for things that I have never heard of before. Maybe this is your engineering background, but all the, you know, the different tools and things. But he's measuring the ice with a, how do you pronounce that word, with an
auger? Was it?
What is an auger?
Pouring down into it, and then he's measuring it. Yeah, you see, this is the thing. My engineering background has been so much a part of my writing. Ultimately, all the shapes and forms I was talking about in mechanical design engineering fit well with the structure of novels and stories and all that stuff. And I have a book of poems out that is all about math and stuff. So it has been an important part of it. And so I think that is the thing when I got into like this book or any of the communities I was living in, I did want the details. I wanted the facts. I wanted all the kind of information on the communities and on the landscape I was living in. I wanted to know that in a kind of scientific way. Mm-hmm. And then I can extrapolate other things from that. So it is very much a part of the book. I think you're right. I got to, just to say, I did get to Churchill several times and I lived up there. That's, so I did have the experience.
Yes.
I went for, in total, probably only a month, but two weeks, once in the summer, once in the winter. I saw the polar bears, my light green.
Yeah. Oh, the bears.
Right up close. It was amazing. And all that, and the beluga whales in the summer. And so I knew I was going to write about it. I just knew that rather than set a book in the community I lived in for 3 years, it was going to be in.
Yes.
Gotcha. Because that it is, you mentioned it was kind of dreamscape in some ways.
Yeah. I think.
And I feel that's what it was like for me going somewhere like that. It's you're landing in this really strange environment because it had been an army base because of its location to Russia and so on. And so it's got all these old army buildings still lying around. It had been a rocket launch, a small rocket launch place for atmospheric measurement and so on. So it's got things like that. So there's all these old dilapidated buildings around, weird shapes and antennas coming out from places and all sorts of things. And on top of that, you have a mixed community of transient people who come to live there. And then there are, of course, the native people, the Inuit people and the Dene people and the Ojibwe people who have been there. And some of these people, like one of the main characters in the book, Tess, is Dene. And that story I knew before going, but they had been forcibly taken from where they lived in a lake and bush environment with deer. And they were forced by the government to come and live on the edge of the Hudson Bay in frozen, icy conditions where there's no, they were used to winters, but not where there is no access to deer and so on. Yeah. And those lives were ruined. And some of the community, many, many years later, the elders got together and said, our people are suffering greatly from all sorts of, you know, social deprivation and so on, and all the domestic kind of problems that come out of that. And they said, we're moving back, whether anyone wants it or not, we're moving back many, many, many years later. But some of the children, of course, had grown up there, and this would be Tess, and it's like, well, this is my home now. I don't know why I'm torn. So the book was about that. It was about, you know, Wade is somebody from the States who just goes to live in Churchill, and really it's a version of me, right? It's a white person coming into a community and in far north and living there, but with Native people, First Nations groups who have been there forever, and some that were forced to live there, and a transient population that happens in these communities. It's a port. Only this week I was reading that they're going to put more money back into the port. It goes in cycles because they ship grain out all over the world from that port. It's a massively important economic base for Canada. Where I had spent time before in Norway House in it, that's the same thing. That was a Hudson Bay developed area. You know, the First Nations people were moving in their camps for fishing or on the trap lines moving for, but Hudson Bay settled it as a fur trapping area. And so I can see the connections there again, how nomadic, not quite nomadic, but people who are on the move suddenly are offered employment if you settle and so on. So all those thoughts were really in my head, I guess. And of course, I mentioned earlier the myth of the West and the cowboy myth, but we had a whole myth of the North that we grew up on too, I think. And I just wanted to find out the realities and not the myths. So I think this story was doing that. It was following somebody from outside the community. All my books are the same.
Yeah,
I've never felt at home anywhere, and that's what they're about. And so this person comes in and is trying to understand, who am I? What am I doing here? And yeah.
And well, yes, I wanted to ask you about his, I don't know, the. So I can't, it's very hard to talk about the book without giving away the book to people. So I don't want to give away the book to the listeners. But I suppose part of it for me was Wade's loneliness. But more than that, I suppose the tricks that guilt can play on you, or the tricks that too much introspection and replaying and reflecting on what you might or might not have done. That was part of it, but also then the kind of transformative power of love, of vulnerability, of risk, all of those things. Gives hope for us all. I was like, great, okay. So Wade is in his 50s when he encounters, maybe the word, encounters Esther. All of the characters seemed so real to me, and yet I can't even find the word. It's not abstract, but very deep, very poetic, very kind of, yeah, like you've fallen asleep and dreamt these people.
Right. No, and I get that, because it, in a sense, I'm thinking, again, because of what I do, I was facilitating a class on Dennis Johnson's Emergency last night, which is a wild story of Dennis Johnson's stuff, where the guy has having hallucinations. But there is a moment in that story where somebody says a snowstorm is coming. And in that moment, anything can now happen, because a blizzard can come in and mm-hmm. a new world can be entered. That was a more hallucination in that story, but that's what was actually happening in this book. You know, when you live in the north like that, there are blizzards, there are moments where you can't see in front of your nose, and you can die if mm-hmm. you're not. And particularly if you're someone like me who doesn't really know the landscape and so on and how to survive in those areas. And I think all of those things are a part of the book, and that one of the obligations of a writer, I think, is to world build always. You know, we think of world building in fantasy, but you have to create a world of what your book is in. And it's not the real world, whether it's set in its own peninsula or whatever, you create a version of a world that's in there, but you also have to create the language that world speaks in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what this was. I would concur with you. I think you're absolutely right. For me, it is a bit of a dreamscape, and there is a dreamy poetic language that goes with that, that they speak. In fact, I had a close call with a publisher of this book way before it first got published in Canada. And the editor wrote me back this fabulous 2-page analysis of the book, but they found the language too formal, which is something I wanted. I wanted a very old fashioned, archaic language. And they found that that didn't work for them. And I think what I learned from that, because I spent many, many more years on the book going back to it, was that I wanted that quality of formality, but I had overdone it on some level and I needed to pare it back. So I would use language like Esther, my beloved.
Okay.
The editor at that time would say, well, you can't say beloved. And I think, well, I think in this world I can, you know? And I wanted, so I was trying to find the language to communicate in this and build the world around it. That is, remember, ice and snow is, you know, it's water, it's fluid. This world is fluid, and it's hardening and it's softening. And that's what I adored about it. It's what I loved about living there, watching freeze up and break up and all that. And then, of course, what you said, and I know we don't want to give something away, but Wade fell in love with Tess, this Danae woman, and they struggled in their relationship. And then he had this very good friend who, like Wade, went to work in the port, and Jack, and they fall out over Tess. And Jack disappears, and Wade blames himself for the loss of Jack, but seems uncertain about himself. Can he tell what it is? So in the book, for those obviously who haven't read it, there's two stories unfolding. There is Wade telling the reader a version of the story, of his story, of all that happened before he meets Esther. And then there's a story of Esther, who he meets later in life, who hears accidentally about his best friend who disappears and wants to solve the mystery for Wade. But if she does, it threatens everything. So there's two narratives unfolding within that, and emerging of those narratives. There's just something about that form that seemed like I don't know that we ever know the full story by the end. I don't know anyone knows the fullness of it, and I won't go into that, but it doesn't have to have absolute clarity.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. And it's all the better for not, I think. But the language is interesting because at the start when I was reading the dialogue at the beginning and I was like, oh, this is odd. But after a few pages, I was like, oh, this is perfectly right. You know, it's and I loved even just the way they say each other's names, you know, yeah. Wade, Esther. There's like a lovely rhythm to it. You can tell I really enjoyed it.
I know, and you're right. Maybe it's important to hear that.
Well, I really hope that people listening get a copy of it because I just can't understand why it hasn't been everywhere. I know it's all to do with publishing and where it's published and distribution and timing and everything else, but
it's got published in Canada, and so it's not really available at all in Ireland. And yes. Now I'm living in Ireland, so it's not getting the push in Canada. I would be able to do on its behalf. The publishers obviously have done their very best.
I'm going to, in a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to read a little passage from The Thickness of Ice. But before we do, because I've forgotten to ask you the last couple of questions about the burning house, because we just completely forgot about them. And I'm just going to ask you the cheeky question, which is if there's a book you would leave in your burning house to burn, because I always want to know the answer to that. So I'll ask you that one first, and then I'm going to ask you about something that you would save that isn't a book, a person, or an animal. So the first one is a book that you would leave in your hypothetical burning house to go up in flames.
Well, you know, when that question was asked, and I just thought about that, I actually, you know, I know we wouldn't particularly rush back into a burning house to save a book.
No, yes, yes.
But the truth is this, I probably wouldn't save it, look for a book in any case. That's just what interests me. It's not that I know it's an analogy, but it is interesting for me to realize that the priority for me at this stage in my life would not be a book. Only this is a sidetrack, but it's connected. Only this week, when I moved back in Canada 10 years ago, 40 boxes of books arrived over my library of books. Mm-hmm. And I had to ask a friend to store them for 5 years. And they came over 5 years later and had to again store them 5 years. And they asked me, can you please take them? We need work done and we need to move the books. And so only this week and last week, I had to move my full, you know, thousands of books. And I thought, I should just sell them. I'll give them away because nobody can buy them now. That's where I was at. It's funny that the books I spent my life, everywhere I went collecting, that I don't have that. They're in me now. The ones they're in me. The ones that I didn't read, which is loads of them, were there on the shelf. And I once had a huge library and they were out everywhere and I could see them. But to go back, they don't have that. That's just interesting for me to know.
Yeah.
They don't have the physical importance they once had. There are books I haven't finished, and I am reluctant to answer that question because it is personal taste. So I don't know what to say a book I would leave behind. There's books I began and just did not do it for me that other people absolutely adore. And it's not that I'm critiquing them, saying if I was reviewing them, for instance, this book isn't quite, you know, all there. It's not that. I grew impatient and I don't mention some of those books. It wouldn't be appropriate, I think. But I'm avoiding the question because I don't want them to burn, but my reading habits are kind of all over the place at the moment.
Well, that's okay. Unlike many Irish writers, you don't have a burning vendetta against someone else that you want to leave.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no. Not, nothing like that at all. Look, we're all in it together. It doesn't mean I like everyone's writing. I do think there's certain writers who are underappreciated. I think there are writers that are overappreciated.
For sure.
I think there's books that come out at the wrong moment in time and don't find an audience. And there's books that just hit the right time and get this massive audience. And that can lead to a lot of infighting and jealousies, yes, and so on. And I'm not immune to feelings, but really we're all in it together. It's a conversation between all the writers and readers. And
no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And the last question there would be a non-book item. So not a person, not a beloved animal. But is there anything, but from what you've just said about your collection of books, maybe I suspect not, but maybe there is something that you would say of an object or a...
I don't think so. I don't think I'm attached to anything in that way. And I have thought about the question because I saw that it could be asked in advance. And you know what came to mind? My passport. And then I thought, no, my passport is, it's easy enough to change back in the day it wasn't, because that's the travel thing. If I lost my passport, that would have been a colossal thing. And if it were to burn up, oh my God, you know. But that was the thought I had immediately. And then I thought, no, you can actually rectify that fairly easy nowadays. That's gone. I think somewhere in my current life at the moment, I have lost attachment to a lot of things that I used to do. Yeah.
I think that is a wonderful place to be. And I think it is quite Buddhist, really. And I agree with you. I think, you know... It's probably a good place to be if you're struggling to think of a possession that you would have to, that you can live without, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a philosophical way to end that, which is not usually the way we usually do. But I'm going to ask you, I am curious to know what section or what part of the book you're going to read from us and where we are in the story.
Yes, and sometimes I've read this piece. It's almost like a little self-contained piece in some ways. I think the thing people would need to know is that Wade thinks a lot about Jack's death and his part in disappearance and his part in that and what has happened to him, and isolates himself for many, many years. Even though he's in an isolated place already, he isolates himself more and has a job still in the port, but his other job is measuring the thickness of ice. And so he's aware of the variations of that. And then he meets Esther, and Esther comes to join him. And Jack has an old house with old memories. And Esther wants to build a new house for them together. And they're going to burn his old house.
Yeah, I love that.
In their stove, piece by piece. And that runs then into the book. And this is a barren landscape because it's in the semi-tundra, up in the semi-arctic there of Churchill. And so there's no trees, and anything that is growing is stunted in its growth. And they bring up logs. So they kind of bring a forest up to this land and literally build their own home. And they kind of get lost in themselves, trying to understand what has happened and who they are and so on. And I think this section is capturing that sense of the landscape that takes over the emotional kind of landscape too. So I'll give this piece a read. The house was everything Esther had hoped for. The wood floors, the log walls, the loft, the high beams. The only reason she would leave it was to come back in. She would look outside at the ice and snow-covered lands and listen to the wind seeking out a crevice to slip through. We are safe here. We have winter leashed. My old house lay in a heap in the back. Joe had pulled it apart with his backhoe and chains, ripped the supports away, tore it to pieces. He offered to let me drive. "It will do you good," he said. "Better than any of those wacky therapies." But I couldn't do it. I could barely stand to watch. All I could see was Jack and Tess and I, the three of us inside, desperately trying to hold the house together while it came tumbling down around us. The first few days after we moved in, I couldn't sleep at night. It was a beautiful home, a marked improvement on my old one, but it held so little of my life. "How did you sleep?" I would ask Esther, and she would reply, "I slept like a log." Outside, the winds increased, carrying the intense cold of the bay in towards us. They blew the falling snow into a frenzy. If we were to look beyond our window, we would have seen nothing. A white void, as though we alone were the only people in existence. If we were to step outside, clothed as we were, we would have died. Instead, we sheltered beneath the bed covers. Our stove burnt the last two planks of wood from my old kitchen floor. It was relentless in its destruction. The heat kept us warm. Esther lay her body on top of mine, and I sank into the mattress under her weight. Our log house creaked under duress. Somewhere, a bear was braced against the wind, treading across frozen ground. The snow blew hard on his downturned head. He was following the path of his hunger. The waters of Hudson Bay beat against the underside of the ice. They had trapped themselves in. The hollow boom of their plight fought to be heard. Esther pressed against my chest and spoke of the Ice Age. She told me how the weight of the glaciers depressed the land here, pushed it down as her weight pushed down on me. The ocean waters flooded in, she said, over 300 kilometers from the current coastline. 7,000 years later, the land is still rising back up. There are lines along the coast, stripes of sandy material showing a succession of beach ridges during the stages of its rebound. Esther rubbed her fingers across my forehead as though tracing the lines evident there too. Later, she eased herself off my body and lay next to me. She looked to see how long it took for me to rise back up again. Outside, the winds persisted. Frostbite, amputation, death. Snow silently walked across our property. It blew in wild from beyond, and then it walked. Sometimes it strolled like an old man, lay down at our door. There are no paths until you dig them. That's what I told her. Esther listened to the howl as the wind found an opening. There's always a way in, she replied. Once more, I knew that I loved her.
You've been listening to the fabulous Gerard Byrne, whose latest novel, The Thickness of Ice, is out now with Baraka Books. See you all next time.